The next week passed with shocking normality. My parents and Dr. Jessica noticed a gradual decline in my outward projection of stress, and they all believed the medication had started working much earlier than they'd expected. Session after session with the doctor yielded the fruit which she'd hoped for. I didn't seem terrified, I didn't speak of invisible monsters, and my smile had returned. The diagnosis of childhood schizophrenia, while terribly in its implication, seemed, to all observers, to serve as the catalyst for a series of treatments which allowed me to resume my normal life. Oh, and I didn't mention the pain my father seemed to be in when he walked. And I didn't mention the cracked, raw skin around Dr. Jessica's mouth that was impossible for her makeup to adequately hide. True to my word, I ignored all the abnormalities that I believed were real, but I couldn't talk about. And the worst was apparently still ahead of me. As the black woman pretended, an increase in the severity of my visions and the real-life effects of the creature's actions on those who couldn't see them would all come to a calamitous head. But I waited and waited, and it didn't happen. In fact, it was the opposite. As time passed, Dr. Jessica's mouth healed and my father seemed no worse for wear. Even the visions that I'd done my very best to ignore were finally beginning to fade. They occurred less frequently for starters, and even when they did present themselves, the potency was little more than a faded nuisance, an afterimage of bright passing headlights during a midnight drive. I was released from the hospital in early July. I began my summer like any normal 7-year-old boy would. I played with my friends, all of whom were happy to see me. My parents still showed signs of concern for my well-being and were reluctant to let me out of their sight, but even their mild paranoia diminished as the heat of the summer cooled into a tolerable autumn. I entered the second grade in September. I didn't see a single full-on hallucination. Every so often, I would see vague shimmering in cracks or corners or behind the clouds. I paid little attention. To be honest, it had gotten to the point where I was convinced that the medication was really helping me. I started thinking that maybe my parents and Dr. Jessica were right about my sickness all along. I excelled in school. To me, my past troubles only gave me a greater perspective on life and made me want to try as hard as I could to do well. And just when I thought it couldn't get any better, my parents told me I was going to be an older brother. I was extremely happy to hear the news. I guess, looking back, I kind of felt like I could be a role model someday in his or her life. When 1986 arrived, I felt better than I'd ever felt. While I infrequently thought about the black woman and fleeting moments of strange nostalgia, I realized that my life was full of so many good things, so much positivity and potential. On the 28th of January, I was sitting in class when a school aide came into the room and whispered something into Miss Carlson's ear. My teacher's normal, joyful expression shifted into one of shocked sadness. Collecting herself with practiced professional rapidity, she thanked the aide and faced her class. She sadly announced to us that something had happened during the launch of one of the space shuttles. The whole class looked frightened and upset. Our school was in Florida, only about 50 miles south of Cape Canaveral. Students would sometimes go on field trips to watch launches with their class. The space program was a deep personal interest of many kids as well as their teachers. Mrs. Carlson wheeled the television set from the corner of the room, pulled up its antenna, and switched it on. The class was greeted by the sight of a single, thick column of billowing rocket exhaust, which had terminated in a large puff before forking out into two thinner tongues of smoke which curled around in serpentine arcs before disintegrating into small, burning chunks of debris which tumbled from the sky. The entire classroom was silent. The weak television signal barely had enough potency for distorted audio, but we could all understand what was being said. A little more than a minute after its launch, the Challenger had exploded, and the crew was not expected to have survived. As the class took in the horror of the disaster, I stared wide-eyed at the grainy picture. As the explosion replayed over and over, I watched as obscene, wreathing tubes of impossibly thick, bloody muscle waved through the air like colossal earthworms. They'd pushed up through the ground and the water, hundreds of them, slashing through the smoke as if celebrating the shuttle's destruction. Far above, in the glorious blue sky of that Florida winter day, holes of black space had opened up as far as I could see. With all the strength I could muster, I tore my gaze away from the screen and looked out the window. The sky above the school was also riddled with holes. Faint stars twinkled within the black malls, and I could see a haze of red strings hanging down like the tentacles of a cosmic jellyfish. I rested my head in my hands, pushing my palms against my eyes with painful force. That familiar light show of amorphous, organic shapes danced in my field of vision. I breathed with slow, controlled breaths, working with great efforts to calm myself down. When I took my hands away from my eyes, the blurriness gave way to sharp clarity, and the holes were gone. The tentacular strings were gone. I looked over at the television with its endless loop of destruction, and I noticed that the tubes were gone too. Then the bell rang. We were being dismissed early. Our principal had made the call based on a rumor that the space shuttle was carrying something toxic, and he was worried it could be carried in by the wind to our area. Outside, the buses were already waiting for the students, so I got on my bus and began the short ride home from school. When I arrived home, I opened the door and wandered toward the den where the television was blaring. My parents hadn't acknowledged my greeting when I came into the house, so I yelled louder and walked into the den area. They were both slumped down on the couch. Thick crimson stains of what had to be blood covered the front of their jeans and had spread down to their knees. I couldn't tell if they were breathing or not. Wet coils of meat grew from the floor and slapped soundlessly against the gray carpet. I called 911 and just stood there, watching it all happen. I prayed and prayed for the black woman to show herself, but she remained absent. The coils grew longer and gathered around my mom. They brushed against her groin and belly with repulsive, seductive, familiar authority. At that moment, I knew she'd be allowed to survive whatever had befallen her. But instead of relief, I felt cold, naked horror. I pressed my palms into my eyes. When I uncovered them a minute later, my view was no different. But I wouldn't let myself cry. My father died before the ambulance got there. The EMTs didn't come right out and say it in front of me, but I caught on pretty quickly when one of them checked his pulse, shook his head at the other EMT, and then immediately went to work on Mom. All three of us were rushed to the hospital. My mom's condition was critical. She was pregnant. And that intensified the situation, significantly. At first, none of the doctors would tell me exactly what happened. They just kept saying that my parents had lost a lot of blood. When I asked them how, they just said they were working hard to make my mother better. I was so scared. I mean, the hospital is supposed to be the safest place in the world, right? Well, I didn't feel that. I just felt like I was alone, with strangers. I needed Dr. Jessica, but she wasn't there. There was a significant amount of commotion going on in the room where my mother was being worked on. Several doctors and nurses were crowded around her. It took a few moments, but then I realized what was happening. They were taking the baby out of her. Oh God, this terrified me. I mean, I didn't really know much about pregnancy, but I knew my mother still had 3 months to go before she was due, and I knew something wasn't right. I refuse to dwell on the next part. When it comes to most of the emotional trauma that I've encountered, I'm usually fine with revealing the details, but the final moments of my mother's life are too terrible, too raw, and I don't want to make myself remember everything. So, to cut a long story short, my mother only had hours to live. She'd lost an unbelievable amount of blood from what the doctors would only refer to as bite-shaped lacerations. They were all around her groin and upper thighs. And like Dad, her femoral artery had been damaged. Only, His was entirely severed, which was why he died so quickly. My mother's wasn't as bad. Still, the ER doctors couldn't fix the wound. And to top it all off, she had to undergo a C-section to save the baby. Her system just couldn't take all the trauma. Before she died, she got to see her baby. I was taken into her room to say goodbye. My mother was gray, and most of the gray was covered with blood. Her blue lips formed the words, "I love you." But her whispered speech was so quiet that I still don't know if I heard her say it or if I just filled in the gaps subconsciously, but after that, I distinctly remember her telling me, "Take care of your baby sister, Joy." That's all I have to say about my mother's final moments. I suffered an emotional breakdown shortly after that, and again I found myself in the psychiatric wing of a hospital. I never saw Dr. Jessica. I had sessions with another doctor, Dr. Fallon. He was kind and capable, but he wasn't the person whom I'd formed such a powerful connection with months before. Along with Dr. Fallon, I spent time with Emma. Emma was my aunt, my mom's sister. She lived up in New Hampshire and traveled to Florida the day after my parents died. I guess my mom had something in her purse detailing what should be done with me if anything ever happened to her or Dad. Emma made the funeral arrangements and took care of their affairs. I didn't attend the funeral. Christ, I was barely conscious. It took weeks for me to finally come around. But when I did, I grieved. Oh, believe me, I felt sorry for myself. I screamed, I threw tantrums, I even hit Dr. Fallon. But slowly, the pain lessened. And my sister Joy was doing exceptionally well. Yeah, despite her premature birth, she was a perfect little picture of what baby health should be. She was so strong and vocal and, as weird as it sounds, mature. A little over a month after the death of my parents, Joy and I were released into the custody of Emma. Emma was 8 years older than my mom, and she lived alone. She was a very successful accountant. In fact, I believe she was the only accountant in the tiny suburban town she lived in. During our time in the hospital, Emma had taken good care of Joy and I. I must say, I'd grown fond of my aunt. I mean, before that, I'd only seen her a handful of times. But I always enjoyed Emma's company. So learning that Joy and I would be moving to New Hampshire to live with her gave me a surprisingly strong sense of hope. I mean, I could start over. Hopefully. We arrived at our new home in early March. I hadn't had a single hallucination or vision since the day my parents died. Something told me it would only be a matter of time before they came back, but I hoped the new environment would make them easier to endure if they did. Plus, I loved Joy. She was the most beautiful baby I'd ever seen. I think she loved me too. She'd always hold my finger in her tiny hand and smile at me, locking her enormous blue eyes on my own. I never forgot that my mother's final words were to take care of her. Protecting Joy became my purpose in life. Emma decided that I should be homeschooled. I thought it was kind of odd, but I didn't really have anything against the idea. And I'd been kind of nervous about starting a new school with new kids and new teachers who didn't know I was being medicated for schizophrenia. That can be kind of embarrassing. Plus, I figured Emma would be a fun teacher, and hey, she was. Since she worked from home, she was always around to give me little lessons over the course of the day. She didn't want to make the experience like regular school. Instead of having a long block of classes, she just integrated subjects into conversations we'd have, and she loved to talk. That part was annoying at the start. I mean, sometimes I just wanted to be left alone, but Emma was always trying to get me to discuss things. I got used to her after a while. Before I knew it, April had arrived to release the frosty fingers of the New Hampshire's winter's grip from around our throats. Deep snow gave way to mud and tiny shoots of plant growth. Emma and I, along with a bundled up Joy, started taking frequent long walks through the thickly wooded area behind her house. Emma, of course, used these walks to teach me about various subjects that she believed were important to my education. One time I held Joy as we walked through a muddy clearing surrounded by white birch trees. Emma talked about the Native American tribes that lived there before they were driven from their land by European settlers. The clearing, where we were standing, she claimed, used to be a very important spot. She extended her right arm and pointed out into the distance, behind the birch trees, and had me look at the long, low stone walls that formed a broken ring around the ground we stood on. Then Emma took Joy from me and asked me to go have a look at an old, thick tree stump that stood darkly against the forest scape just beyond the wall. She said she wanted to know what I thought of it when I returned. I obeyed. As I walked closer to the stump, I realized how bizarre it looked. I'd never seen a tree stump like that in Florida. It was very thick, like maybe 6 feet wide and just a little bit taller. Hundreds of thin branches extended from the black trunk like grasping skeletal arms. When I was standing directly in front of the thing, I examined its surface. It was darker than any wood I'd ever seen. Almost like it was painted. Knots and blemishes covered its bark. And in the cool, early spring breeze, the limbs looked as if they were trembling, like it was shivering or something. When I'd gotten a good look and was ready to head back to Emma and Joy, a powerful gust of wind blew me directly at the tree stump. I stumbled and grabbed the stickly limbs to regain my balance. A couple of them broke off into my hands, but I was able to steady myself. I stared at the black bark of the tree. I felt wetness on my hands and glanced over at the branches. Dark red oozed from the breaks in the wood. I wiped my hands on the front of my jacket and looked up. Tens of pitch black eyes opened in the center of the tree and met my gaze. The musical, wordless voice of my lost friend, the black woman, filled my mind. I backed away with uncomprehending surprise. I looked behind me and I could see Emma and Joy watching me. Both of them were smiling.
Take it easy. Take it easy on the truth serum. No more of the, we're alive. And they're kids. It's me, Mr. Creepypasta.
And I like midget porn.
Ooh. Mm-mm. Hi there, kids. It's me, Mr. Creepypasta.
And I'm a Russian spy.
До свидания.
Hi there, kids. I'm Mr. Creepypasta.
And I just pooped myself.
Everybody has like, whoa, just? Hey there, kids. I'm Mr. Creepypasta.
And sometimes, when nobody's looking, I go to the dog park and I sniff the dog's butts.
Hi there, kids. I'm Mr. Creepypasta.
And I'm a cam model. Ties ribbons to his penis and dances to Taylor Swift.
Not even just saying that, you're just coming to self-realizations and just like not wanting to be here. Hey there, kids. I'm Mr. Creepypasta.
And my mother once told me I was adopted.
Hi there, kids. It's me, Mr. Creepypasta.
And I'm Vincent Vinicava.
And today we're here to talk to you about the Creepypasta comic book. You guys probably heard us talk about it before when it first went to Kickstarter. Well, now it's available for everybody and not just the backer.
April 7th. On Amazon. Follow the link. Supplies are limited.
Very limited, in fact. But you don't want to miss out on this. And it's also going to be the start of the Spooktacular this year. So you'll be able to find out what actually happened to him, whose body was stolen by Bizarro, and me, who's still stuck in the deep web.
Oh, yeah! I don't know. I just thought it was like it was like a catchphrase.
Oh, yeah! Snap into a Slim Jim! Dig it!
Ah, welcome. I take it you've come for a story. Of course you did. Why else would you have tracked down my website? After all, it takes a very special browser to even locate this dark little corner of the internet. But you already knew that. So, if it's a story you want, it's a story you shall receive. And it would please me very much to read one to you this evening. All of you. Shall we begin? I've got the perfect one in mind. It's a tale about those who've been wronged and the depths they'll sink to in the name of revenge. The Creepypasta comic is available on Amazon April 7th.